I just want to explain that I decided after such a long life without smoking that I'd start smoking, and so I got this cigar, and here I put the burn in up to my face, and got burned. It really was dumb, wasn't it? No, that really isn't what happened. I've been trying to move the wash area for Gene, and I've been soldering some pipes, and his solder is dripping down and burning my face and hands, that kind of stuff. So, the other story was better, wasn't it? Okay, will you open your Bible to Genesis chapter 46 and verse 28? We want to simply finish this chapter where we started off last week and then deal with chapter 47, which is Joseph's Social Security program for Egypt. Genesis 46, verse 28. At this point, Joseph has revealed himself to his brethren. They have returned to Canaan, told their father that Joseph was alive, took the wagons with him and all the equipment to bring him and all of his family down into Egypt. And so they arrive, that caravan of that clan, Jacob's clan, arrives in Egypt. So when they're coming in on Highway 1, let's see, this is the, we're not on 47 yet, but anyhow, this is the coastline, and over here is the Dead Sea, the Jordan Fault, Sea of Galilee, and they had been living down here in the area of Hebron and Beersheba. Okay. Now, they most likely headed right out for Highway 1, which runs right along the coastline. It's along the maritime plain and comes right down this way into Egypt. And when they came into the vicinity of the Nile Delta here, they most likely sent ahead, as we read in verse 28 of chapter 46, and he sent Judah before him unto Joseph, that is, Jacob sent Judah, to direct his face to Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen. Now, Goshen is this area right in here of the Nile Delta. In other words, it would be almost the northeast extremity of Egypt. And Joseph in chapter 45 and verse 10 had told his brethren that that's where he was going to try to get them settled. So on the way, the old man Jacob was saying, well, I wonder where we're going to stay in Egypt. I don't know. I've never been to Egypt. What do you think about this? And they were saying, well, Joseph has it all prepared. We're going to go to Goshen. So notice that the old man, he's 130 years old, he's still in command of these boys. They are in the vicinity of 40 and 50. And it's Jacob that sends Judah. Interesting that he sends Judah in the sense that he apparently now has confidence in Judah, since Judah apparently has become the spokesman and the authority figure with the brothers. So they sent to Joseph as to precisely where they should go, and they stop sort of in this area and await the return of Judah. So in verse 29 we read, and Joseph made ready his chariot. He had a Porsche 924, and he had it all serviced and ready to go, and so he jumped in his Porsche and headed up Highway 1 to Goshen. Okay? And he went up to meet Israel, his father, to Goshen, and presented himself unto him. Now that's exciting. They have not seen each other for 22 years. The old man has expected that Joseph was dead and has only recently learned that he was alive. And they are just they're struck dumb. They can't talk. So we read, it says, he presented himself unto him, and he fell on his neck, and he wept on his neck for a good while. So here is this son and this old man hugging each other. The son is 39 or 40 years old. The old man is 130. They're hugging each other. Finally, Israel gets up enough gumption to say something. Verse 30, said to Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because you are yet alive. Okay? So they have arrived. We have at least 70 that are named that are with Jacob. They know of the approximate area that they're going to dwell. And now all that's left is to get that finalized. So Joseph decides to give them a little coaching. He gets them all together and he begins to advise them on how to deal with Pharaoh in this issue of settlement and so on. So that is the next passage, verse 31. Joseph said unto his brethren and his father's house, he gathered everybody together and he gives them an orientation. I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, my brethren and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed, in the King James it says cattle. Every place you find cattle, you should translate it livestock. Every place you find corn, you should translate it grain. Their trade hath been to feed livestock. They have brought their flocks, they have brought their herds, they have brought all they have. And it shall come to pass when Pharaoh shall call you, he's going to say to you, what kind of work are you in? And then you should say to him, verse 34, thy servant's trade hath been about cattle or livestock from our youth even until now, both we and also our fathers, that ye may dwell. And Joseph says, say this, put the emphasis on the fact that you are identified with livestock, not with sheep. Say this, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. Say that so that Pharaoh doesn't resettle you or diversify the location where you will live. Emphasize the fact that you deal with livestock because, last part of verse 34, every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. Now that's an important verse because for a long time, this book of Genesis was the only record that we had on Egyptian history. Well, we had other records, but you see they were obelisks and pictures on tombs and so on, the Ramesseum in Egypt and so on. The only records that we had of Egyptian history, and really there aren't a lot today, are these markings on the tombs. And always in the markings on the tomb, if a person was a shepherd, he is always portrayed to be real skinny, emaciated, dumb-looking, sort of out of it. The book of Genesis, in every reference to Egypt and Egyptians in terms of culture and society, is 100% on the beam and always has been. And it only was recently that scholars who used to laugh at the Bible have had to come to that position. Shepherds, sheep tenders, were looked down upon by the Egyptians. Now this is a kind of a proof also that apparently the Hyksos had not been there. Okay? Are you familiar with that term? Let's give a brief overview of ancient Egyptian chronology. Ancient Egyptian chronology. We'll try to do this as rapidly as we can. You have sort of the adolescence of Egypt between 3100 and 2700 BC. By the way, these dates are breasted dates. Breasted dates. Breasted was the man who coined the term Fertile Crescent. He was an ancient historian. He's been dead for probably 40 years now. But nearly everybody follows his dating. The Old Kingdom of Egypt ran from about 2700 to 2300 B.C. Okay? We'll put circa here, means about. This was the classical age of Egyptian history. This is the age when the pyramids were built and the Sphinx was built and so on. The capital was near Memphis, up across from Cairo. They had a solar calendar, they had physiology, they had hieroglyphic writing and so on, majestic art and so on. Around about 2200, they began to experience a decline in terms of military capacity and so on, and they were defeated by a group called the Nomarchs, and so they entered into what is called an intermediate period. So the first intermediate period, which really isn't too important for us, runs from about 2200 to 2050 B.C. And then you move into what is known as the Middle Kingdom. Now this is important because this is the time when Joseph and Jacob goes to Egypt. The Middle Kingdom dates from about circa 2050 B.C. to 1800 B.C. This terminating date is in question. Not for sure when that happened. In the Middle Kingdom, the capital is moved to Thebes. And Thebes is in Upper Egypt. And Upper Egypt is where you would expect Lower Egypt to be. Upper Egypt is down, well, you have to say up the Nile. Let's go back here. This is up. Okay? And this is down. And yet, let's not get more confused. Up here is Cairo and Memphis, and down here is Thebes. And so the capital moves. So if you go to Egypt and you want to trace the history of Egypt, you get on a boat up here and you ride down the Nile. And you will stop here and see the Cheops pyramid, Khufu, and so on. You get on a boat, you'll go on down, and you go to Thebes, and you'll stop at Thebes. And you'll visit there for a long time because there are marvelous temples and so on there. Then when you want to get up to ultra-modern times, in terms of their near history, you have to come up here and visit Alexandria, which is here, which of course was built by Alexander the Great. Okay? So anyhow, in the Middle Kingdom, the capital is moved to Upper Egypt at Thebes, and the pharaohs regain some of their prestige, but nothing like in the ancient kingdom. Okay, now this is important. And in this kingdom, we know that the priesthood grows stronger. We're going to see that in Genesis. Grows stronger and stronger in Egypt. Okay? And Joseph and Jacob go to Egypt. Now I want to show you something that's important historically. The next intermediate period, the second intermediate period, see, if you point out the second, you almost have to point out the first. If somebody's thinking, they say, well, he pointed out the second, but he didn't say anything about the first. Don't you find this tremendously exciting? No. The second intermediate period runs from about 1800 to 1570. You might find the date 1580. Now this is important because this is the reign of the Hyksos. The Hyksos kings. These Hyksos kings were invaders, most likely from Canaan or from the upper reaches of the Babylon area, of the Mesopotamia Valley. In other words, they were foreigners who came down and began to settle in northern Egypt and then succeeded in taking over the nation. And there is debate whether these are shepherd kings. The older writings that you read about the Hyksos will call them shepherd kings because they were like nomadic Shemites. Just like Jacob and his family. See? The newer writings on the Hyksos will simply call them ruler types. That's not the right term. I can't remember the second descriptive term they used, but they were ruling kings or something to that effect. Whatever. Whatever their description, they had taken over Egypt. And they were favorable, see, to Jacob and his family. Now it's thought that one of the reasons that they were favorable was that they were Shemites, and the other reason was that they were shepherds. See? Okay. Now, you will find, if you read commentaries on Genesis, and there are not very many good commentaries on Genesis, you will find somebody saying the reason shepherds were an abomination to the Egyptians was because of the Hyksos. That is not true. They were abomination to the Egyptians simply because the Egyptians looked down on that occupation. The Hyksos were not even there yet when Joseph was there, is the point I'm trying to make. The Hyksos antedate Joseph. They come after him. And this verse is proof that the Hyksos had not been there yet. Okay? Had the Hyksos been there, Joseph and his family probably never would have been able to get in, if the Egyptians were in control. And it's very apparent in this passage that the Egyptians are in control. See? Not some foreigner. So the Hyksos has not been there yet. And this verse helps us date almost categorically the time that Joseph went into Egypt. Okay? Okay, we know that Jacob goes to Egypt in 1876 B.C. Okay? So he is going to live there 17 more years. He will not make it into the period of the Hyksos. Whether Joseph did or not, we're not told. Okay, let's go back now to the text. In chapter 47, which is the chapter I want to try to cover tonight, we have the Social Security system. Social Security in Egypt. And this had all been planned, or at least a large part of it had been planned, as we have seen, by Joseph. Now, if you want to take notes, the outline of this chapter is very simple. The first thing that we have in the Hebrew text is an emphasis on the fact that Joseph cares for his family. He is going to take care of his brethren. And this is the emphasis of verses 1 through 12. And the way that he begins that is that he introduces them to Pharaoh. Okay? And he takes them into his court. Verse 1, verse 2, verse 7. Let's look at it. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan. And behold, they are in the land of Goshen." And as we said, that was prearranged. And he took some of his brethren, even five men, and presented them to Pharaoh. We're not told which ones they were. Probably took Judah. Probably took Reuben, who was the oldest. Probably took Benjamin, who was the youngest. And as I said before, they're in their 40s, they're in their 50s, right in the prime of life. And takes them in, and here these big strapping Jewish young guys are with their big heavy beards, you know. And down in Egypt, they shave, you know. And they have their... nomadic type clothes on, like bathrobes. They got their bathrobes on, colorful bathrobes. They go in and they meet Pharaoh. Okay? So in verse 7, after that audience, then there's going to be a private audience with Jacob. So the first thing that Joseph feels is necessary is that they be properly introduced to Pharaoh. Okay? Okay. The next thing that has to be done is to have Pharaoh's approval. It must be Pharaoh who provides Goshen. So we have provision of Goshen by Pharaoh. And of course, as sort of the prime minister of Egypt, Joseph has been trying to encourage Pharaoh in this direction. But Joseph could not make the final decision. You see, he could have been charged with nepotism, or with maybe malfeasance of office or something like that, if he would have made the decision. But if Pharaoh makes the decision, none of the Egyptians can come back on him. So he ushers them in, and the first thing Pharaoh said, as Joseph anticipated, is in verse 3. What is your occupation? What do you guys do? I guess that's a common question, isn't it, when you meet somebody. What kind of work are you in? He says, what is your occupation? And they said to Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds. Now that word for shepherd is the same as the word for shepherd in verse 34. In other words, they didn't dodge the fact that they were shepherds. In fact, they reinforce it. They say, we are shepherds, ra'eh, both we and also our fathers. In other words, the family tradition in our family has been that we are shepherds, which normally involves a little bit of ranching. Okay? And they said, moreover, unto Pharaoh, for to sojourn in the land are we to come. In other words, their attitude was that they are only going to be there for a very, very short time. So they say, we are only sojourners, for thy servants have no pasture for their flocks. Of course they didn't, due to this 7-year drought, which has been going on now for 2 years. For the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Now therefore we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Okay? Now it's important, you see, why did Pharaoh ask them what is their occupation? He asked them, what is your occupation? Because he has to locate them. Now, he apparently already knew what their occupation was. But nevertheless, he asked the question because that is imperative where he's going to locate them. If they were stonemasons, they may have been moved down the Thebes to work on the temples, you see, that type of thing. If they were builders, they would have undoubtedly gone to Thebes. But they're just stockmen. And so they ask him, could we dwell in Goshen? So in verse 5 it says, and Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brother are come unto you. The land of Egypt is before you. In the best of the land make thy father and thy brethren to dwell. In other words, Pharaoh says, you, Joseph, you can make the choice. You can pick any place you want in Egypt, and it's yours for your family. Okay? But fortunately, he goes on and he suggests Goshen. In the land of Goshen, let them dwell. Because Goshen is the best place for cattle. And then he says, and if you know any men of activity or any capable men among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. He says, I might as well. These guys look like they're capable. They probably know what they're doing. Take care of my cattle also. Okay? Now, what we need to point out here is the three-pointed advantage of Goshen for Jacob. There are three distinct advantages of this geographical location. One, it provided abundant pasture. It provided abundant pasture. I mean, that was like living down in New Orleans. All the silt and so on that came down the Nile River was deposited in that delta. It was the most productive part of all of Egypt. By the way, it also produced fish. When you get to the book of Exodus, you find that they ate an awful lot of fish. I guess that's true if you live in New Orleans too, isn't it? At least if you eat at Molly McIlvaney's, you're going to get a gumbo Creole fish dinner. Okay? So this is ideal for livestock. The second thing is it provided segregation. It provided segregation. Okay, now there were several reasons for that segregation. One of them was because it was somewhat isolated. It was somewhat isolated from the populous regions. There were no large cities in Goshen at this time. Later on, the Hebrews will be made to build two cities in the land of Goshen, treasure storehouse places. But they were isolated from populous centers. Moreover, they were isolated because of the kind of work that they were going to continue to do. They were stockmen, and these people were not liked by the Egyptians. But the geographical location and the occupation they had kind of assured them that they would not be assimilated. Their children would not intermarry with the Egyptians so that they would be assimilated with Egyptian people and lose their identity. And of course, Messiah could not come through the Jews had that had happened. Point three, it provided easy access to Canaan. Easy access to Canaan. Okay? In other words, it was contiguous with southeastern Canaan. This is kind of exciting in view of what happens at the Exodus some 430 years later. Here they are in Goshen, and here is Highway 1, and it's about a three-day journey to get to Canaan. I mean, to get into this part of Canaan. Okay? And yet when they make the Exodus, they don't go this way. God leads them down. The Red Sea comes right up here. The Red Sea points right up at Goshen. God leads them all the way down here through the Red Sea, way down here into the Sinaitic Peninsula, down to Mount Sinai, and he starts them up here, takes them up almost to Beersheba, and what's the name of the spot where the wanderings begin? They send spies up into the land, and then they because of their negative report, they wander for 40 years, where they could have made it to Canaan in 3 days. And of course, there's a reason given why God led them this way. He led them this way because the iniquity of the Amorites was not full. The time for judgment upon these people had not come, and he wanted to take a little time with Israel. He tested them in the wilderness. Regardless, this was a strategically located place because it did have easy access to Canaan if they would have to get out in a hurry. Okay? So, it is provision of Goshen by Pharaoh that is the emphasis of this paragraph. Back to verse 7. And Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh. Now a unique thing happened. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Now that is unique because Pharaoh at this time was probably the most powerful man in the world. I think we could say that because Hammurabi comes in the 18th century. We're still in the 19th century BC. And Hammurabi in Mesopotamia comes in the next century, and he was probably most powerful in his day. But Pharaoh was probably the most powerful man in the world in his day. But from divine viewpoint, the most important man in the world of this day was this old man, this old shepherd, who's all beat up by now. He just feels all beat up. He's beat out. He thought he was going to die when he was 77 years old. And he really didn't die. And then he had trouble with his sons. And then Joseph went down and he thought he was dead. And he feels like a beat up old guy. But he's the most important man in the world. And the Bible says he blessed Pharaoh. Now there's another text in the New Testament in Hebrews 7 that says the less is always blessed by the greater. Now, how he blessed Pharaoh, we're not told. But apparently, Pharaoh responds very positively to what Jacob did, to the person of Jacob. He says, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of my pilgrimage," here is Jacob's self-image at this point. "The days of my pilgrimage," first of all, he sees himself as a pilgrim, a stranger, "are 130 years. Few and evil have been my days of the years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my..." Wait. "Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been." King James is hard some places. "And I have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my father in the days of their pilgrimage." Now all he did was ask him how old he was. He could have said 130. But he added some things, and it kind of indicates the way he's thinking. He said, "I have not lived into longevity like my father Isaac, who lived to be 180 years old, or my grandfather Abraham, who lived to be 175, and I feel all beat up." Evil here is the word ra'ah, which can be translated chaotic. "Few and chaotic have been the years of my life," and they really were. He had to struggle with his uncle Laban for 20 years. He came home. On the way home, he runs into his brother that had threatened to kill him 20 years before. Got that straightened out. Went down to move into the land, and his wife Rachel, that he loved very much, died in childbirth. And then he had the problem with Joseph being lost, and then now this horrendous crisis with foodstuffs. So he's sort of giving his attitude toward life. He says, my days have not, they've been chaotic. Then in verse 10 we read, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh again and went out before Pharaoh. And apparently what had happened was that Jacob had invoked the blessing of God on Pharaoh. See? And Pharaoh apparently responded to it. Okay. Verse 11, and Joseph placed his father and his brother and gave them possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses. Ramesses is a later designation for the Goshen area, and there'll be a city built there named after Ramesses or Ramses. And Ramses is a pharaoh of the 13th century. Oh, I forgot to put the new kingdom up. 6. Oh, I left one thing out at the end of verse 12 that's important. And Joseph nourished his father and his brethren and all his father's household with bread or food. Now notice this, according to their families. Now that point should really go under this first section. He rationed. Rationing was in order by Joseph. He was a very, very fair and upright, honest public administrator. He is not going to treat his family any better than he treats other people in Egypt. He rationed his family according to their families. Those that had more children got more grain, more foodstuffs. Okay? Okay, now his Social Security program begins for Egypt. Let's begin in verse 13. And there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they brought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So the first thing that you have is verse 13 and 14. You have purchase at a fair price. Purchase at a fair price. In other words, the Egyptians and the Canaanites had to purchase the grain as long as they had money. This is not going to be a welfare government subsidized program where the government just doles out the food. The crisis is very serious, but Joseph refuses to just give out the dole and make everybody dependent on the government. Okay? The word for money that is used here is an interesting word. It's a common word. It's the normal word for money. It is the word kesef. Kesef. And kesef literally means silver. So the medium of exchange was not funny money, but silver. So that the Canaanites could bring their silver to Egypt and exchange it for grain, just like the Egyptians could exchange their silver for grain. Okay? Now, there is no rebellion, there is no revolution in Egypt over the fact that there's no grain, there's no food, because Joseph has made provision. And now his program goes into operation. But it stands to reason that the money is going to run out, because nobody is having a crop. And these people, of course, were agrarian culture. They depended on crops for their money. So in verses 15 through 17, the money runs out. And we have a barter system. In other words, the medium of exchange has to change since there is none around. Verse 15. And when money failed or ended or ran out, in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money ends. And Joseph says, give me your livestock, and I will give for your livestock if the money is gone or ended. And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses. Here is indicative that cattle means livestock. Horses for flocks, for the cattle, the herds, and for the asses. And he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. Okay. In other words, the crisis now deepens. As time goes on, it gets worse. But they had been forewarned. See, they had been preparing for this for 7 years. So even though the money runs out and the livestock runs out, there is still no social anarchy in Egypt. And one of the major reasons that there is not is because they trust this prime minister. They have confidence in their public servant, who is Joseph. At least he's the key leader. Okay? Now there's only one thing left. When you run out of money and you run out of materials, they traded their stereos and their TVs, they didn't have anything left. Well, there's only one thing. Okay? And verse 18 through 20, they're going to trade that. Land for foodstuff. Okay? Land for foodstuff. They do own some of their land. At least some of them did, see? Okay? Verse 18. And that year was ended. They came unto him the second year and said unto him, "We will not hide it from my Lord, how that our money is spent. My Lord also hath our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in sight of my Lord but our bodies and our land. Wherefore shall we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh. And give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate." Okay? Now, it is the people that suggest this alternative. Joseph did not suggest it. This is the same as feudalism. In feudalism, the lord of the manor owned all the land, and then the people would serve on the land and bring their product or a part of their product to the lord of the manor. And the lord of the manor then set up a protection for these people. He would protect them physically, and they would provide the labor, but everything was owned by him. So what you really have in Egypt is a degeneration, so to speak, into sort of a feudal state, where the government is going to own all the land, and the people are going to be sort of chattel servants or chattel slaves on the land. Okay? But it is the people that suggested it, not the government. So again, there is no social revolution in Egypt despite the catastrophe they are in. Okay, this necessitated something else. A relocation to the city. In other words, to feed these people, they had to be in a place that was more centrally located. And so verse 21. Let me read verse 20. "And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, and the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them, so the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them into the cities, from one end of the border even to the other end thereof. And it's in those cities that he had stored the grain from the 7 years of plenty." Now there is an exception to this. Verse 22, point E, the priests are an exception. And the wording of this is interesting. Okay? "And the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion." Now that word means an allotment, "assigned to them of Pharaoh. And they did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them." Notice it doesn't say that Joseph gave it to them. This was a direct appropriation by Pharaoh himself. And it was a way of tying the priests into the government, into dependence upon the government. If you couldn't control the priests in what their thinking was, you could at least control how they how they were subsidized, how they lived. And it was a form of control. It was a state religion. In other words, you had a church-state situation, as you would expect in ancient times. Okay? So Joseph couldn't have anything to do with the priesthood. And by the way, the priests emerge as a strong, because they have their own land, they have their own portion, they emerge as a very strong political force in Egypt at this time. Okay? Wherefore they sold not their land. Then Joseph said unto the people, verse 23, Behold, I have bought you this day, and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. Okay, now what you have there is the last stage of this social insecurity system. Verse 23, voluntary servitude. Voluntary servitude. Okay, they are chattels of the state. But you know, Joseph is very, very fair. Watch the program he works out for them. Verse 24, It shall come to pass in the increase that ye shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field, and for your food, and for them of your household, and for food for your little ones. So they had a fixed income tax of 20% income tax to Pharaoh. Okay, now during the 7 years of plenty, when Joseph built the storehouses, what percent of their crop went to the government? 20. Same thing. In other words, in the 7 years of plenty, when Joseph set up his bureaucracy in preparation for this disastrous 7 years, a law was passed that everybody had to give 20% of their grain to the government, and they stored it in the storehouses, remember? Okay? Now the people are destitute. See? But he doesn't take advantage of them. It is still the same. This is necessary to run the government, to keep this program going. It was categorically necessary. He only takes enough that is necessary. What then is the only difference between this and that time? Well, yeah, that's a difference. They don't own the land. But what other difference? They're taking in less. They can't produce because they're not having abundant moisture. But you must realize, of course, that in Egypt, they depend upon the Nile anyhow a lot. There's a lot of enormous irrigation in Egypt than there was then in ancient times. So they still had some crops, but it was nothing like it was, of course, before the drought. So they're taking in less. Okay? So they get 20% for income tax and 80% for the chattel servant. And that really is not unfair. Let's see. Monday's paper, I read one article where it said the average American is paying 34% tax to the government. That's average. If you're in an income tax bracket that reaches above that, of course you're paying more. Not too many people are paying less. In other words, we're paying 34% right now. So 20% really isn't too bad. It's all relative, right? Okay. What I'm trying to point out is, look, Joseph is not taking advantage of their plight. Hence, you don't read of any social anarchy in Egypt. Okay? In fact, the system must have worked so good that in verse 26, whoever Moses most likely was writing, it says it's still the law in Egypt today. Okay? So let's read verse 24, their response. And they said, Thou hast saved our lives. Let us continue to find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. They were very willing to do it. It was voluntary servitude. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day. And if this part of the Bible was written by Moses, and it was not some document that he had, then that means this had carried on for 430 years after. The Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests, which became not Pharaoh's. All right? Okay, so that is Joseph's Social Security program. And it was much more better managed than our Social Insecurity program today, to put it mildly. My Social Security went to 1,654 dollars. Somebody says, "What's it mean to be self-employed?" I tell them, "It means I get to give the government $1,654 next year in Social Insecurity, money which I'll never see again. Which I would prefer to invest in something, you know, real estate, whatever. Give it to buy stocks, whatever." I'm sorry. Didn't mean to burden you with that. Last days of Jacob, verse 27 through 31. Last part of the passage, okay? Okay. Now, this is a contrast. This is a contrast to what we've read before. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen. Now, Israel there becomes the name of this whole clan. Notice, Israel, and then they had possession. Israel dwelt, it meant the whole clan. And they had possessions therein. And their possessions grew. And they multiplied exceedingly. Not just their possessions multiplied exceedingly, but they multiplied exceedingly. So you have a contrast. Remember, there's five more years of drought. Despite the drought, verse 27, you have an increase in material possession. Okay? Prosperity. And numbers. Okay? Now, how rapid that growth rate was, we're not sure. But a 5% growth rate, remember there were only 70 people that went down. A 5% growth rate for 100 people over 220 years would equal 2 million people. And I think that's figured at about 120 years for the average life of a person. We read in the next verse, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so that the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. So his lifespan continued for 17 more years. And the time drew nigh that Israel must die. You ought to underline that in your Bible. In other words, there was a time, there was a moment in Jacob's earthly life when physical life was going to end. And there was an allotted time. And God says, "Hey, it's time." You know, I don't know if he said it to him. Jacob anticipates it. In fact, he's been anticipating it for 70 years. He's like a lot of people you know today. You know, how do you feel? "Oh, gee, I got one foot in the grave and one foot on a banana peel. I really feel half dead." He felt that way for 70 years. But this time, it's for real. His time is up. And so the emphasis of this next paragraph, verse 28 through 31, is an oath in anticipation of death. He is going to extract an oath from Joseph. Verse 29, "And the time drew nigh that Israel must die." That's true of all of us. We don't know when that time is. "He called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, the hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt." I'm going to die, and whatever you do, don't put the tomb or the grave here in Egypt. Okay? And he extracts an oath. And the way that you signal that oath was the same that we found in 24:2 when Abraham sent his servant to get a wife for Isaac. He says, "Put your hand under my thigh." That's a statement that you ought to read about privately, because it's really dealing with a way of securing an oath, and it's kind of hard to talk about in public. Nevertheless, the statement is used twice in Genesis, and it assured Jacob when Joseph would do that, that this would he would fulfill the oath. Okay? It says, "I will lie with my fathers. When I die, carry me out of Egypt, bury me in their burying place, which is in the cave of Machpelah at Hebron." And Joseph says, "I will do as thou hast said." And he says, "Take an oath, swear it to me." And he swore unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the headboard. I don't know if it's queen size or king size, but it's what it says in Hebrew. He had a headboard. When you read a book of Hebrews, it says, Hebrews 11:21, it says he bowed himself on his staff. And so somebody says, well, there's one of those contradictions in the Bible. In Genesis 47:31, it said he bowed himself on the headboard. In Hebrews, it says he bowed himself on his staff. Well, for crying out loud, the old guy is 147 years old, and he's sitting there talking to Jacob, and he knows he's going to die, and he gets up from where he's sitting, he puts a staff under his one arm, and he leans on the headboard with the other arm. And when it says he bowed his head, he probably bowed his head in prayer. You know, isn't it possible to lean on something and lean on two things? Lean on the headboard and lean on a staff? Well, of course it is. So, you know, why make a big deal out of it? Important thing in the passage is he anticipates his death and he's going to die. And the next two chapters record the last two events of his death. And really fun chapters. We're going to find, well, what this old guy does as he gets all of his sons. First Joseph brings his two sons in to bless him. And then he gets all of his sons in. Here he has this clan, you know, these boys who are now 60 years old. He gets them all in around his bed, and it says he threw his feet over the edge of the bed. Throws his feet over the edge of the bed, and then he goes around. He says, now, here's what you did, and here's what's going to happen to you, and here's what you did, and here's what's going to happen to you. When he gets to Judah, he says, out of you, there's going to come a prince of peace. It's going to reign. It's the promise of Messiah. He keeps going around, pronounces a blessing. And when he gets all done, he throws his feet back up in the bed, lays his head back, and it says he gave up the ghost and he died. Just absolutely beautiful. Picture of Old Testament death and a guy who knew it all the time. He isn't rattled. He isn't all shook up. He just makes all the preparations and sees that all the business is covered, and then he dies. He expires. Okay? Any questions about the passage? Next week we'll take chapter 38. And part of 39, 39 is very important because of the prophecy that Jacob utters over the heads of his son. We'll take each one of those separately to show you how they are fulfilled. Any questions? All right, let's close in prayer. Thank you, our Father, for this opportunity to study your word together. We ask the blessing of the Holy Spirit and the application of it for the edification of each one, the encouragement in the days ahead, in Christ's name. Amen.